Hello and welcome to Conker's Corner. Today I have the privilege of speaking with Steve Holdsworth. Steve is a private investor, formerly a charity fundraiser, and he's an active investor and trader in stocks and shares. More recently, Steve has set up his own blog, and we're going to discuss today Steve's journey with regards to investing and trading stocks. Hello, Steve, and how are you?
Good morning, Peter. I'm very well, thank you.
Now, Steve, thank you ever so much for agreeing to do Conker's Corner with me today.
The pleasure's mine.
There's a few people out there that have been anticipating this interview, and I'm hoping that we'll do you justice today.
Absolutely. Let's do our best.
Okie doke. Now, Steve, as you know from listening to some of the Conker's Corner that I've done in the past, I always like to start with giving the audience an introduction to who the individual is I'm speaking with. So I just wanted you to share your background with regards to, you know, as a child, first interests, etc., please.
Sure thing. Well, I was born in Bushy in Hertfordshire in 1963, and we lived nearby in Boreham Wood until I was four. And then the family moved to Perivale, a small suburb in West London, in 1967, when I was 4 years old. My father was a self-employed carpenter, and a very good one, I hasten to add. And my mum mixed up bringing in two children with various office secretarial type jobs. So it was a kind of fairly ordinary upbringing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and regards to that, schooling, did you have siblings?
Yeah, sure. Well, I've got one younger sibling who's a very successful man and a guy who I admire and look up to very much. I don't think he invests actively himself, but he does very well. So I went to Perivale Infants and Middle School, then to a school a little bit up the road called Northolt High School, which was a pretty ordinary, large, comprehensive. I was kind of bright enough to get into the top stream at pretty much every subject without trying too hard, but I lacked the kind of drive that I really needed to excel at anything in particular. Looking back, I consider myself fortunate that the two subjects I enjoyed the most and therefore paid the most attention to were maths and English, which I think with hindsight was probably a good thing. I did leave school at 16 with a handful of O-levels. I can't remember how many. I know that the grades were fairly average because I didn't really do much work. And I got my first job in 1979 as a junior at a local branch of Barclays Bank, funnily enough.
Oh, excellent start. So with regards to Barclays Bank then, when you say a junior, was that an administrative tasking job or were you...
Oh, yeah, very much in those... Yeah, I mean, in those days, a banking junior's job, it's all changed now. But, you know, I was probably spend the morning stuffing statements in envelopes and that sort of stuff and posting it out and then perhaps doing filing in the afternoon. I think there was a lot of tea being made as well.
Yeah.
It was that kind of job for the first year. And then after I'd been there for a year, I sometimes got to serve behind the counter as well. So I was there in total for about 4 or 5 years, I think.
Right, okay. And what happened after that, after Barclays?
Well, I kind of realised that it wasn't for me. I didn't want to make a career out of it. So, funnily enough, my next job, I went to work for a Tandy store in Edgware Road in London, which is long gone. But I did that for a year. Trouble was I wasn't a very good salesman, which when you're trying to sell things to the public, isn't that great? So, Really, from the rest of the 80s and also the 90s, I just really went through a series of jobs. You know, I always say that I'd never really had a career as such. I mean, it was mostly office jobs. I worked for the Ministry of Defence for a while. I even drove a forklift truck for a year or so, which was great fun. And I have to say, through this time, I had little or no interest in investing at all, to be honest. If anything, I'd have probably mildly disapproved because I was a bit of a lefty in those days.
Right, okay.
So, not anymore.
No, that's fine. I mean, this is the whole point of the journey, isn't it? You know, we all have different views in our 20s to our 30s to our 40s, etc.
So, oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So with regards to not having much of an interest then in the 90s regarding investing and stuff like that, what was it and when was it that your interest in shares changed, Steve?
Yeah, sure. I'll answer that. I was working just in the late 90s, it would have been. I was working for a very large market research company, which at the time was called Taylor Nelson AGB. And this was just at the sort of early days when the internet became became kind of mainstream, as it were. And there was a few people that I worked with who did have an interest in shares. And it kind of piqued my interest a little bit. But what really happened was that during this time, I was actually in a fair bit of consumer debt, you know, the loans and the credit cards and what have you. Basically, I wasn't earning very good money and I was spending more than I earned without having any fantastically outrageous habits. But I needed to do something about it. And I somehow stumbled across a website, which I'm sure most of your listeners will be familiar with, called The Motley Fool. And in particular, it's discussion boards. And there were some boards on there which were basically offered practical help to people on how to clear themselves of debt. And that's kind of how I started it. But what I noticed on the Motley Fool boards is that there was all these other boards with wonderful names like Paulie Pilot's Pub and High Yield Share Strategies and stuff. And I just started to read them because a lot of the posts on those boards tended to get on the best of board, which is like a hit parade of the most popular ones. And I just found the whole world of it interesting, and I slowly but surely became interested in it, even at the same time as I was finally clearing off my consumer debt.
No, Steve, I've got to agree with you there. There's been so many people I've spoken about that have such a fond memory of, you know, the Motley Fool as it originated in the UK. Obviously, it started in the US, but, you know, some fantastic boards there and some fantastic individuals who were just sharing information, wasn't there?
Oh, it was absolutely wonderful. I mean, I say it's early days. I joined in about 2000. It had been going a few years then. But during those early to mid sort of noughties, whatever you call them, you know, people who you've interviewed on here, people like David Streder, Mark Bentley and others, you know, they were freely giving of information. And there was so much learning. And for someone who's a quick learner, and I am a quick learner, I just found it quite captivating. And I haven't known before or since a forum where people shared so willingly of information. And also at the time as well, they used to do monthly London socials in central London. And I started to attend a few of those, not all of them. And it was a great chance to meet people like David Streder and others in person and really talk to them and get to know them. And I think that as much as anything made me feel, hey, these are real people who are investing in these shares and they're doing very well for themselves. And I was thinking, well, if they can't do it, why can't I? Absolutely. Apart from the fact, of course, I didn't have any money at the time.
Yeah.
But it was a great learning for me. It really was.
Yeah. Motley Fool has inspired many, many people. I think one of the interviews, if you've missed it, that I've done on Conker's Corner, I've done with a chap called Mark Rogers. Now, Mark started off writing on the bulletin boards of Motley Fool, and he's currently the managing director of Motley Fool and also the chief investment advisor for Motley Fool Hidden Winners. So it just shows what Motley Fool has done for certain individuals.
Oh, absolutely. I must admit, I haven't heard of... I must admit, that's one of your interviews that I haven't heard, but I will certainly make a chance to listen to that one as soon as I can. So thank you for that.
No worries. Now, what I wanted to ask you, given the fact that now you're nurturing your learning, you're exploring, you're doing your research via Motley Fool, when was it and how did you get to the stage where you could make that first investment, Steve? And if you don't mind me asking, what was the size? Because obviously when you've got very little money and you're clearing your debt, you don't have a lot of money free then to invest.
Oh, yeah, I don't mind answering that at all. Now, when did I first invest? Well, the answer is, to be honest, sooner than I ought to have done, because I was still basically trying to clear debt. And to anyone who's listened, if you're in debt, clear that debt first, and particularly in those days. But I was impatient. So my first ever share purchase was, I think, in about 2005. I bought some shares in Lloyd's. What was it then called? Lloyd's TSB.
Yes.
So I didn't have an internet account, so I phoned up Hargreaves Lansdown, who is still one of my brokers, and, a complete investment virgin, as it were, saying, please, sir, I'd like to buy £2,000 worth of shares in Lloyd's TSB. And they talked me through it, and that was fine. So that was my first ever share, which, of course, I picked Lloyd's TSB because, you know, it's a big, safe FTSE 100 blue chip yielding. What could possibly go wrong with Lloyd's TSB, you know?
Of course.
Oh, but as it happened, I sold out prior to the financial crash, so I didn't do too badly on that. But that my first sort of 4 or 5 years of investing were very much like that, very sort of ad hoc purchases. I didn't really have portfolio at the time. I just kind of bought and sold shares as they took my fancy. But it was a very good learning curve because some did well for me and I learned from those, and others didn't do so well. But at the time, because I was only doing it in fairly small amounts of money, it was a very valuable lesson. It really was.
Absolutely. Now, Steve, I'm interested now because as a PI, lots of PIs want to learn how you learnt your journey. So you're using Motley Fool, different, you know, various bulletin boards, but what research were you then doing after you'd done and read what you'd read on Motley Fool to say, I'm going to purchase Lloyd shares or whatever shares after that?
Oh, yeah. Well, again, in those very early days, I really wasn't doing very much beyond having a look at tips in the Financial Times. When I started to take it more seriously, I found that Digital Look was a very good website for screening. I still use it occasionally, but there's others now as well. There was no Stockopedia in those days. But I had two or three friends who invested who were able to help me. I always tried, and I still do, I'm very much a value investor most of the time. I try to look at the price earnings ratios and the dividend yields and the cash flow and that kind of thing. So it was really from the start trying to improve my skills of fundamental analysis by reading a lot of books and going on various websites, which at that sort of time, I'm now talking about the sort of late noughties, if you like, they were becoming more and more easy to use and more friendly. There was one called Hemscott. I think it's now been taken over by Morningstar. That was at the time a good source as well.
Yeah, I mean, Hemscott was used by a lot of the professionals as well back then, wasn't it? And still Morningstar is today.
Oh, right, yes. Yeah. I wasn't aware that. I do still use Morningstar occasionally, I don't use any kind of premium service or anything, which presumably the professionals do. I don't know.
Yeah, many of them do. Now Steve, you describe yourself as a value investor now. When you first started out and you were doing your, ad hoc sort of research and following sort of tip sheets, what sort of stocks were you buying then when you first started out?
Oh, goodness, anything and anything. I mean, really, there was no discipline at all. I mean, one that I did very, very well on, and goodness knows how, because I think it went bust, actually. There was kind of an ambulance chasing type insurance company called Accident Exchange. That's right. I remember it was discussed quite a lot on the Motley Fool boards, and it was a very controversial one. Some people loved it and some didn't. So I remember that I bought, probably about £2,000 worth of shares in those. And I must have timed it absolutely right. I was only recently, after I'd agreed to do this interview, having a look at some of my records. And, I think in the space of about 2 or 3 months, I'd virtually double bagged on that. And then I sold, so I've done really well on that. But on the other hand, another one that was a bulletin board favourite as well for a long time was a company called NXT. I don't know if you remember them.
Oh yeah, the flat speakers.
The flat speakers that they never could make sound any better than a transistor radio playing in next door's bathroom. So that was kind of my first, I say, a big mistake. It was big in terms of making a lot of mistakes and financial loss, because every time that they did a rights issue or a placing, which was very frequently because they never had any money, I always seem to top up. And I probably lost quite a lot of money on that one. I mean, not a huge amount, but I wasn't there right till the end. Funny enough, what happened with that was it was one of my first ever annual general meetings. And afterwards or before, they actually had some of their products on show and everything, and it was crap, sorry. But one of the centerpieces was a big birthday card that you opened it up and it played the Birdie song.
Oh.
And they were showing this at their AGM to impress people. And I must admit, I sold out after that. But it cost me what was probably at the time, I guess, probably about a month's take-home pay. So it wasn't a disaster.
Yeah.
Again, in those days, it was very much that kind of thing.
Okie doke. But I think it's great that you went to the AGM, because this is the whole thing about looking these CEOs and CFOs in the eye, and also if they're putting the products on, you can actually see them, So what a lot of people are starting to do now is actually trying to coordinate with others to do investor visits to the actual offices or the manufacturing plants of companies if they're listed in the UK. That's really good.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't ever done any of those, but I'm fortunate enough to live in London. So I do go to quite a lot of these shareholder seminars, which are held by the likes of ShareSoc and Equity Development and Proactive Investors, etc. There are others as well. I think Shares Magazine do them as well. And they're usually quite a nice opportunity to hear what the chief execs and CFOs have to say, and also to network with fellow investors. I think I find these things useful, though it's important that one doesn't get too taken in, because, you know, most CEOs by their very nature are very good salespeople, so it's quite easy to listen to what they say. And, you know, I'm sure some people think, yeah, I'm going to go out the next morning and buy some of that, and then probably regret it later. But, you know, I find these things interesting. I do know that they're not to everybody cup of tea, though, and I can see both sides.
No, that's absolutely true. It's one of them that you've got to mix and meld, actually, regarding certain companies. Now, Steve, I'm conscious of the fact that one of the significant things you did between the 80s and the noughties was to clear a significant amount of debt, you know, and at the same time, prior to finishing that, you started investing. Now, that's an achievement in itself, really, you know, which I've got to commend, because getting yourself out of debt is a significant issue for so many people.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I actually had quite a following at the time on the Dealing with Debt board, and the model pool. My username was Go Stevie, and I think some of my posts are still there. But oddly enough, the discipline of clearing a huge amount of debt, I think, actually put me in good stead as an investor, because it made me very, very good at record keeping and very meticulous. So, you know, I became a wizard at Excel spreadsheets. Yeah. And I actually think that having those years of very carefully clearing debt and never missing a payment and all that sort of thing, when it came to investing seriously, which I started to do in about 2013, that really, really helped me. I'm convinced it did.
No, that's absolutely spot on. I think it's great to, a prerequisite, really, of people keeping diaries and logs of what they've bought, why they bought it. And it does work with regards to investing, most definitely, because, you know, things change regarding stocks. And you've got to go back and say to yourself, why did I buy that again? And what did the CEO or CFO say 3 months ago? And why are they saying something different now? And you can judge that as to whether or not to stay with a company, you know, or stay invested with it.
You know, I absolutely agree with that. Funnily enough, again, I was having a look at my records and I made notes of some of my biggest early successes and failures. And I'm having a look at some names. I couldn't now even tell you what some of them do. You know, it's ridiculous. You know, but there's others that I did very well on. But there's one or two companies. I mean, there was a company I invested in. I've got it down as one of my biggest failures. A company called Blur. Nothing to do with Damon Albarn. Couldn't even tell you what they do nowadays. I just can't remember.
Yeah, lots of people got bitten by Blur. Now, Steve, I wanted to ask you, I think you describe yourself as a value investor now, yeah? But are you more long-term, mid-term? How long are you turning to old stocks once you've bought them, or are you watching the news flow?
Oh, it's a bit of each, to be perfectly honest with you, Peter. My sort of large, well, not necessarily my largest holdings, but holdings in big companies that I've got in companies like Shell and Lloyds, again, funnily enough, I tend to view those as large dividend paying rump holdings. And, you know, I've held, you know, some of them for a good few years, and I've no real intention of selling. More on the mid cap and small cap. So I would say that, you know, I mean, I have been known to buy a share and it's put out a profit warning literally the next day and I've sold it. But I would say on average, my holding period is probably about 6 months to 2 years. But that's very, very approximate.
Okie dokie. So with regards to your stocks that you like, is there a particular sector that you prefer? Are you a tech person? Are you into building and construction? Are you into, you know, pharma? What's your flavour that you like?
As far as tech goes, I think you know how tech savvy I am from last week when you're trying to get me set up on Skype. And I think if you'd had any airlift, you'd have torn that out then. But no, joking apart, I quite like media companies, marketing companies. I think possibly because I worked in market research for a good few years. I'm not saying I understand the ins and outs of them, but I'm more comfortable with them. Some tech technology companies I'm quite keen on as well. I recently took part in a placing for a company called Rosslyn Data Technologies, which I think is quite exciting. But I would say that, so I'm, you know, for the sake of disclosure, I'm talking my own book there. So that's what I'm keen on. On the other side, I very, very much avoid what I call holes in the ground. So apart from the big boys like Shell and BP, there's so many junior miners and junior oil and gas stocks, and you've no way of knowing which ones are going to succeed and which are making money, and frankly, which of the managers are honest and which ones aren't, if I'm being honest. So,
absolutely.
You know, I avoid, to be honest.
Yeah, no, there's a lot to be said for due diligence and lots of research into the backgrounds of any listed company, whether it's a tiddler in the oil sector or mining sector or in the FTSE. You know, it's research, research and research. And then you don't have to go in early with these, you know, newly IPO'd stocks or that's been on the AIM or the FTSE for a very short space of time. Just watch and watch and watch.
Yeah, I very much agree. And somebody who I've learned an awful lot from in that respect is one of your previous interviewees, a good friend of mine called Wheelie Dealer.
Oh, yes.
You know, who's a genius, that man. But he's very much one who says, you know, buy on the gains. Don't attempt to buy right at the bottom because you'll almost certainly call it wrong. He's very keen on buying on momentum, and I'm very much coming around to that side of thinking. You know, I've tried to buy things on the way down. So yeah, you know, IPOs, let them float and see how they go, because there's some which look really good. And yeah. I think a particular trap is when companies IPO and they dangle the carrot of a 6 or 7% dividend yield. That's often a trap. I mean, I don't know if I should name companies or not. I'll go on, why not?
You can give one example, go on.
N2 was one, and Flow Group, I think, was another, which, you know, they started off by offering yield, and then within a year or so, they've issued 2 or 3 profit warnings, and you've suddenly lost 3/4 of your money, and it's really hard to make it back. And I think when it comes to IPOs as well, it's really important to know why the company is IPOing. Is it because they genuinely are a growth idea and they need extra funds to fuel that growth? Or is it just that the original owners want out because they realise that they've probably reached a point where they aren't going to make any more money? I think that's so important with IPOs.
That's a very, very good and valid point you've made there, Steve, and appreciate you sharing that. I think one of the things I would add to that caveat is that there are lots of really good companies out there that IPO and will have a nice yield, but you have to do your research to filter through the ones that are that 10% that are going to be genuinely there 2 or 3 years and able to maintain the payment of 6%. If they're not actually making the margins that they claim originally, that 6% is going to get absolutely diminished to nothing. And like you say, they could be down 30-40%. You know, if you're looking for steady income, find a company that's going to be steady and going to be around there for 5-10 years.
Yeah, it's very, very hard, which is why I don't usually take part in IPOs. I've done one or two, but generally I do try to avoid them. Frankly, I'm not clever enough. You know, I'd much rather have a company float for 3, 6, 9 months or however long.
Yeah.
And basically see how it goes after that and then decide to put my toe in the water.
No, that's a very, very good point there, Steve. It goes on to my next question, really. I mean, and it's about the research side of things. What are your essential criteria when researching companies that would lead to you, Steve, now, you know, given what you've learned from the 80s, 90s and noughties, to pushing that buy button?
Well, almost without exception, and there will be exceptions, I want companies that make a profit. You know, I've just quoted Rosslyn Data Technologies, which is a bit of an exception. But generally, I like companies that make a profit. And also, I'm very keen on companies that pay a dividend, however small, because I find that if a company, even if it's only paying a 1% or 2% dividend, it keeps the directors' minds focused on cash flow and on shareholder return. So I'm very keen on that. Although, again, one has to be careful that one isn't buying into a value trap. So ideally, I want everything, but ideally, I want a company that's making money and paying a dividend yield with a little bit of growth as well. I mean, one of my favourite stocks, if that's the right word at the moment, is a media company called Centaur Media. The Epic is CAU. And that ticks all the boxes for me. They make money. They're on a fairly low PE yield. On a PE ratio. And they're paying a good yield. And I think that there is some growth opportunity there as well. So that's just one example that I am a current holder of. That kind of ticks the boxes for me at the moment.
Excellent. So with regards to what you've learnt now in the past 20 odd years, 30 years nearly, Stephen, what has been your greatest lesson that you've attained since you started investing and attend? I mean, because you've said earlier that you attend these meetings, you're looking at the CEOs, you're looking at the products, you're attending these seminars. What's been your greatest lesson thus far?
Oh, well, there's a few. I mean, I think one thing is don't ever become too overweight on any one particular holding. You know, I did that once with a company called Tungsten, which I know an awful lot of people got burnt on. At one stage, it was over 50% of my portfolio, and it's by far in real money terms my biggest loss. And I would never get into that situation again. So certainly, I think, not becoming overweight in anything, although I don't have a particularly wide portfolio. I think I've probably got about 10 to 12 shares at any one time. I'm comfortable with that. I think, as I alluded to earlier, it's so important not to get taken in by very charismatic chief executives, because most chief execs are very charismatic, and some, you know, it's easy to get taken in by. And you know, I think those two lessons in particular for me, you know, keep your position size sensible so that if something goes totally wrong, it won't completely make a huge amount of difference, and really drill down on those numbers, because it's those numbers at the end of the day which are going to make you money, not a charismatic CEO or anything else, to be honest.
Yeah, I think we've all been there, Steve. I think the difficulty is that if and when you get a charismatic leader, and he obviously sells it first to the city of London, right? And then the Indeed. PR companies do the next thing, and then, you know, before you know it, it's all over. You know, as we now use the internet, Twitter, you know, all the bulletin boards, and then all of a sudden, you know, there is, what's the word? It's almost like a groupthink situation going on, and all of a sudden, if one person steps out of line, or a woman steps out of line, and says, actually, I don't believe in this company, that person is getting rained down with a negative noise forever. Oh, how dare you question?
You see it so much. And to be honest, that's what made the Motley Fool boards so good in those days, in that they were very closely moderated and they didn't allow that sort of stuff as much. Some of the other ones, you know, it can be like the Wild West. But certainly that is another lesson I think that I try to stick to, is that I try to avoid the latest hot stocks on the bulletin boards, because once it's a stock that everyone's talking about, you know, it just gets out of hand and everyone's buying it. You know, I think once something becomes the hot stock to talk about on a bulletin board, you probably miss the boat anyway, and there's more that can go wrong than that can go right.
Yeah, I have to agree with you there. I mean, I get a lot of criticism via DMs and on Twitter, because if there's lots of noise around a stock, I get questioned as to why I haven't talked about it and why I haven't bought it. And it's because I say, as a contrarian, if there's lots of noise there, that's the last place I want to go. And invariably, a lot of the oil stocks and the little mining stocks that a lot of people are talking about, I will not go anywhere near them, you know?
Yeah, I think you're wise. I mean, as I say, I don't touch these small oil and mining stocks anyway. But you find in any sector that there are certain, as you say, there are certain bulletin balls, and as you call it, you get this kind of groupthink. And as soon as anybody dares to say, "Hey guys, this might be going wrong," then they start to get trolled and abused and everything else. So, you know, that's something to, you know. You know, I do post on the bulletin boards, though nowhere near as much as I used to, and I try to be sensible. I hope I usually succeed. I'm sure sometimes I don't.
No, it's all about acceptance, really, and the fact that we should all have, if we want to share, a view on something, and that should be our view. It doesn't have to be the same as anybody else's, you know, and without chastising anyone else for having their own view, you know, and just be have a modicum of decorum about yourself, you know. And there's not enough of that, unfortunately, now on Twitter. I think there's far too many people that, you know, have a couple of pints of a night time and think it's time to become a keyboard warrior and be abusive to people. It's not really needed.
I think we all know a few of those, but I shan't slander anybody by naming them now, but I'm sure that there's one or two who are saying, who, me?
Yeah, well, you know, the world's a better place with kindness. That's the way I find it.
I could not agree more, absolutely.
Okay, Steve, so what's been your wisest investment decision to date?
Oh, wisest investment decision to date? Well, I'm thinking of my successes, ones I've done very well at. One I did well at, but not as well as I should have done, was a company called BioVentix, which I'm sure you've heard of,
yes.
Most of your listeners.
Yes, a Leon Boris favourite, that is.
Yes, that's right. I was going to say, one of your former interviewees, Leon Boris, basically put me onto that one. I mean, he's a hugely clever guy, Leon.
Very clever.
When he speaks about shares, you should listen, believe me.
Agreed.
But that's by the by. But I bought into BioVentix when they were about... In fact, I know exactly what I bought them for because it's a memorable number. I bought them when they were 666.
Wow. Okay.
Funny enough. But they actually did incredibly well for me. And I sold, I think, when they were about... When I just about... double bagged, I think they were about £12 or £13, but they've just gone up and up and up, so I sold too soon on that. And another big success of mine, well, in fact, I'll give you a real contrarian one that I made a lot of money on, was actually Quindel Portfolio, believe it or not.
Well, you're one of the few, chap. Go for that one. Explain that one for me.
Well, yeah, I've actually got I've got the numbers now. I mean, we all know what happened to Quindel. I'm not sure if it's actual fraud, if whatever happened. But I originally bought in May 2013 when they were about 7p, and I sold very shortly afterwards at 9p. So that was a nice little profit. But then I bought in again in June 2013 for just under 10p, and then I sold right into the rise. I sold some at 16, some at 32, and the rest at 39. I made a huge profit on that in about 8 months.
That's exceptional. When, and again, we had they had a very charismatic leader there as well, didn't they?
Oh, Rob Terry, I must admit, I haven't ever met him personally, or I don't think I have. But yeah, you see, there again, you get these very charismatic leaders. But just with Quindel, just so that I'm not only singing when I'm winning, I did have a final punt in March 2015 at about 155p, and I sold a couple of months later with a small loss when they were about 130p. But that, overall, I made a gain of about 70% on, which for a company like Quindel, I think I did rather well out of.
Absolutely.
I'm sure it's more luck than judgment, but anyway.
No, very, 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 very good, Steve. Now, Steve, I'm conscious that we've not touched on your blog, which you very kindly started last month. And you gave an introduction as to who you are and what you are about, and some of the your best bits. And your more recent one, you touched on regarding lessons learned, which is, you talked about.
I think it was
tungsten. I just wanted to just give a little shout out here for your blog, which is at gosteveblog.weebly.com. So for those that haven't been introduced yet to Steve's blog, please pay it a visit. It's very, very insightful, and it's exactly what you want to see. This is me. This is what it says on the tin, is who I am. And it's very well written, by the way, Steve. So very well done with that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I mean, I've only started it fairly recently. And again, I want to make a big shout out here for Wheelie Dealer, because it's his own blog which really eventually inspired me to start my own one. So I would thoroughly recommend to anyone who hasn't already seen Wheelie Dealer's blog to also have a look on that. That's easy to find. There's a huge amount of great stuff on there. As you say, I only started mine last month, because I've always had a full-time job. I actually leave my job in two or three weeks' time. So I shall be spending much more time on investing and hopefully adding some more interesting stuff to the blog, hopefully.
Yeah, no, well, I'm looking forward to reading some more, Steve. And yeah, I would agree regarding Wheelie. For those that haven't visited yet, it's a must read, really, because he's absolutely exceptional. And the speed with which he gets these blogs and articles out is just ferocious. You know, it's absolutely incredible.
Oh, he's so prolific. He's absolutely prolific. And he tweets prolifically as well. I don't know where he gets the energy from. I really don't.
No, he is good. Now, Steve, you've had many lessons. You've cleared debts. You're now, very thorough regarding your research and the stocks that you investing and the stocks that you trade. And you've shared some of your many lessons that you've learned already since you started investing. If there was one that you haven't shared yet, what would you share with our audience regarding your learning and your journey so far, please?
Well, I'm going to give the most cliche one in the world, but please try to enjoy it, because if you don't enjoy doing something, then chances are you won't be able to do it very well. I thoroughly enjoy investing in stocks and shares. The whole mechanics of it, of doing the research, of doing the buying, of looking the charts and doing anything, I could never give a chunk of money to a funds manager and ask them to do it for me. I enjoy it too much.
Yeah.
You know, that's why as of next month, for a short time at least, I'll be, you know, I will be an investor as my main source of income. That I won't do that forever. But, you know, the main thing I would say, you know, if you're an investor, enjoy it. And if you stop enjoying it, then maybe you want to ask yourself if it's time to take a break or not. I think that would be the main thing, to be honest.
No, that's very good advice there, Steve. Thank you for sharing that. Now, given the fact you've been in the markets for such a long time, on and off, and watching it and reading about it, Steve, and you've seen various things happen and change, if there's one thing regarding the investing landscape that you could change, what would that be?
Oh, I will answer that straight away. It's a bit of a bugbear of mine. The fact that so many shares that are held by private investors are held in nominee accounts. So anything in a SIP or an ISA, and most dealing accounts as well, you know, a private investor's shares are usually held in nominee. And I don't think many people realise that, you know, if you hold shares, no matter how many in an ISA or a SIP or in most trading accounts, your name doesn't appear on the company register. You know, it's all pooled in with, you know, it will just appear under the name of the stockbroker. Now,
yeah.
Some brokers are fine. They will arrange for you to attend AGMs if you want to go and to get the paperwork and to vote and stuff, and some won't. But I think that's all wrong. And I'm going to give a big shout out here to ShareSoc, because I know that they work very, very hard to try and change this system so that if anyone holds shares, then their name appears on the shareholder register. And they are not just the beneficial owner as they are now, but the legal owner. And I feel very strongly about that. And that's something I'd like to change. And it's why I'm very proud to be a member of ShareSoc. So anyone who isn't, if you don't mind me just basically giving a plug, please do think about joining them, because they do some great campaigning work in that respect.
I absolutely agree with you there, Steve. I was speaking with Mark at the Master Investor Show, and you know, and I forget his first name, the chap surname of Dennis,
Mike
as well.
Dennis.
Yes, at the time, and yeah, they do an exceptional piece of work down there, and with all the different shows that they do. And investor rights, and yeah, you know, Share Talk have been behind them and supported them, you know, since we've been
live
the website as well. So yeah, we're very passionate about shareholder rights, and they do a stellar job. Sometimes, you know, they don't get the recognition that they should, but they do a lot with the government and also with the FCA, as it's called now, to try and make things better for investors.
Indeed.
Now, as you know, Steve, I'm a big fan of my books, and like you, I like my research, and I like to continue to grow and learn, you know, because I think continual learning is very, very important. Now, are there any books, Steve, that you've read recently or read historically that you would say, you know, that was the book that made a bit of difference regarding how I view things now? Or is there a book you're reading right now that you'd recommend?
Well, there's one that does spring to mind that I enjoyed immensely, and I still reread occasionally because I find it inspiring. It's a little bit out of date now. It's a book called Free Capital,
yes,
by a guy called Guy Thomas. And it's basically he's done sort of pen portraits or interviews with 12 different subjects who've made millions on the stock markets. And it's basically there's a sort of one chapter on each, and it tells each and every one's story of how they did it, and they're all very different. There's 12 subjects. Two of them are actually named. Lord John Lee is one of them. Peter Gillihammer, excuse the pronunciation, is the other. And there's two or three others on there who I do know who they are. In fact, there's one at least who's been interviewed by you. I'm not going to say who it is because it's not, but I think we all know. But that's a great book for anyone who's interested in the stock market, because, as I say, slightly out of date now, but it's just 12 very different true stories of people who have become successful on the stock market. I'd thoroughly recommend that one, to be honest with you, Peter. That's the first one that comes to mind.
And once again, I would agree with you. I've read the book. I've interviewed a couple of people out of the book, and it's an exceptional book because it's not about... It's about... There's so many different approaches to investing. There's some different strategies to investing. And if you do it right, irrespective of your strategy, and you're disciplined, then you can make it work for you.
Yeah, that's the key word, isn't it? You've got to be disciplined with it. You really have, absolutely.
Right. I'm going to ask you a slightly different question that I haven't asked anyone else before now, Steve. So you're my tester here with it. Now, given where you were 10 years ago, in May of, 2007, where and what would you like to be doing in May 2027, 10 years hence?
Oh, well, I mean, that's a nice, easy one, actually. I'm 53 now. I'll be 54 next month. So in 10 years' time, I'll be 63, 64. I hope to be happily retired, still investing on the stock markets, basically living off the income that hopefully a large portfolio by then will enable me to do. I hope I'm still in good health, obviously. I think everyone does. But, I'm a long way from being in that kind of position yet. But that's kind of what I'm aiming for. Eventually I would like to be, because at the moment I really like being an active investor and stuff. But I'm sure that as I age, it's quite likely that I want to become less active. So that's kind of where I would like to be in 10 years' time. But I don't think, while I've still got any sort of faculties, I don't think I will ever stop actively investing to some degree or another. I really don't.
Okay, thank you for that answer, and thank you for answering it so quickly as well. I know I threw that one at you a little bit.
You're welcome.
Right, so Steve, given what you've just said, I'm going to close with this one final question. Sure. If you were starting out investing today, right?
Yeah.
What would you do that you had not considered or unable to do back in the 80s, 90s?
Oh, well, I mean, it's a lot easier now, because one thing, it's so much easier and cheaper to invest now. I mean, my earliest shareholdings back in the 90s were in paper certificates. So, it's so much easier now. I mean, I would say to anybody who wants to actively invest, get yourself, a good execution only broker, open an account with them, do as much research as you can. Again, it's so much easier than it is now. Research, and just basically get in there and get stuck in. I'm not a fan of paper portfolios, funnily enough. I know some people are keen on them. I'm not. I think until you actually get in there, even if it's only with a small amount of money, get some skin in the game. It feels very different when it's real money than when you're just messing about with matchsticks or whatever, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So you're a fan of the research. You're a fan of seeing and visiting the CEOs and going to seminars. If you were starting out today, Steve, right, and there is one CEO out there that you would say to people, this is a man, woman CEO who has done, a lot of good work. Who would you say that would be?
Oh, there's a guy called Graham Purdy from Ilika. He's very, very good. I don't hold shares in that company at the moment, but he's a really honest guy. He's a CEO who you can trust. There's others as well. But you've put me on the spot there, Peter.
I think it's important space. Because what happens is this, Steve, right? And having been doing this now for 20 odd years, right, and more, is that there are certain individuals, and I live in Leicestershire, so I'll always say Lord Wolfson, for instance, given the fact that a lot of the person that was doing the admin and was administratively cleaning the building of Next were given shares at 2p, 4p, 10p. And at one point, more recently, in maybe 2014, 2015, the shares were £80 each. So that cleaner became a millionaire if she just put her, £10 a week away in Next shares. And he's always been the sort of person that was consistently under under giving estimations regarding what could happen than over delivering. Now, what happens with a lot of CEOs and CFOs is they overestimate, overtalk the market and say we're doing exceptionally well, to then come in and say we're not doing so well.
Yeah, and I'll tell you another one who's really good. The chief executive of Bioventix, he always under-promises and over-delivers. Yeah. His name's Harrison. Is it Peter Harrison? But he's a really honest guy, without question at all. He's another really good CEO.
Okie dokie. Now, Steve, I want you to just close by saying, no, when we had a proper chat at the Master Investor Show, that, you know, it was really, really nice to meet you properly. But we initially met the year before that, at the Master Investor Show, if you remember that as well.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed.
And that's when Wheelie and I had organised that group of people with Mark Bentley. And we had like, I think there's a dozen of us there all chatting and sharing information. And I think if it's down to Wheelie, myself and Diana, we'll be organising another one at some point in the summer. So I look forward to that.
Oh, I very much look forward to that. That was great. I mean, I left that fairly early. I think some people basically carried on into the night with that one. Quite messy, I think. But yeah. No, that's fantastic. People like Wheelie and Diana and yourself and Mark and stuff. No, that's great. And as an investor, you can't beat socialising with your fellow investors over a drink or a cup of tea if that's your, you know, what you fancy. I think it's really important and it's great fun too, Peter. It really is.
Okay. Right. Steve, I've finished my questions. Thank you ever so much for sharing that. It was a very, very lively interview and I know it's going to be thoroughly interesting for everybody. I look forward to seeing and meeting and speaking with you again soon. And when I'm going to publish this, I'll give you a little heads up. Okay.
Thank you very much, Peter. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much. That's been fantastic.
Thank you, Stephen. I look forward to reading your next addition to your blog, mate. All right? So take care and God bless.
Good. Thank you. God bless. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.